Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are taking a stack of sources about a book that really pushes back against, well, how we're sort of told to feel these days. We're diving into Susan Cain's Bittersweet, How Sorrow and Longing Make Us Whole.
Yeah, and it's, it's not just another self-help book. It feels more like a cultural argument, almost. Cain directly tackles what she calls the tyranny of positivity.
That phrase really lands, doesn't it? The tyranny of positivity. It's this relentless pressure we all feel to just perform happiness.
Constantly, and it's everywhere.
It is.
Yeah.
Look around. The message is basically, if you're not happy, you're like failing somehow. And if you feel melancholy or real sorrow, people tell you to what? Cheer up. Look on the bright side.
Exactly. Or be grateful, which isn't bad advice in itself, but it often shuts down the actual feeling.
Right. So this book, Bittersweet, it feels like a huge validation for anyone who's ever felt, a bit off or flawed, because they carry these deeper, more complex emotions.
Absolutely. Cain's central idea is that this capacity we have for sorrow, for that kind of wistful longing, it's not a weakness. It's not an emotional defect. It's actually a core human strength.
A strength. How so?
Well, she argues it's really essential for making genuine connections with people and for creativity, too. We need to kind of reclaim this whole emotional state that our culture has mostly pushed aside.
Okay, so before we really get into the nuts and bolts of the book, let's talk about Susan Cain herself, because she has a track record of shifting how we think about these fundamental parts of being human.
She definitely does, yeah. Most people probably know her from Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking.
Huge book. Changed a lot of conversations.
Totally. And her background's impressive. Princeton, Harvard Law. She was a corporate lawyer before she became this major writer and researcher.
And what's really striking, I think, is her method. With Quiet, she took on the extrovert ideal, this idea that being outgoing is the only way to be. Now, with Bittersweet, she's kind of doing the same thing, but for the positivity ideal.
Yeah.
And she uses that same blend of, hard research psychology, neuroscience, cultural history.
Right. But she always weaves in these really personal stories, her own and others. It grounds the research.
I mean, her own authenticity seems key here, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
She said she herself has this bittersweet temperament.
Yeah, she puts herself right in there, which makes her a really powerful advocate because she gets it from the inside. It gives her this unique position to ask, why do we insist on this cheerful kind of one-dimensional emotional landscape when real life is just so much richer and more complicated than that.
Okay, so if Bittersweet is her, cultural manifesto against forced happiness, what exactly is this bittersweet temperament she's championing?
Right. So, crucially, it's not clinical depression. That's a different thing. Yeah. She defines it more as a personality trait, and it has maybe three main interconnected parts.
Right.
First, a really deep sensitivity. To beauty, yes, but also to suffering, feeling things intensely.
Mm-hmm.
Second, the sharp awareness of impermanence, the feeling that everything passes, the good stuff, the bad stuff. It's all temporary.
That knowledge that things end.
Exactly. And third, this tendency to feel joy and sorrow almost at the same time, holding them together.
That idea of duality, light and shadow together, that's really powerful. She calls it perfect imperfection.
Yeah, I love that phrase.
It sounds like just accepting that life is messy, and that's not just okay, it's maybe even good.
It's more than okay, she argues. It's actually vital for wisdom.
Right.
And the book's scope on this is huge. She traces the sensitivity through evolution, philosophy, like Plato's idea of striving for perfect forms.
Plato.
Yeah. And music theory, spiritual traditions. She's basically showing that feeling things deeply isn't a modern problem. It's actually this historically recognized path to human flourishing.
All right, let's get into the details then, because this is where she really gives us the language to think about our own feelings. She starts by making a really important distinction, doesn't she, between just sadness and something deeper, like sorrow.
Yes, that's critical. She draws a clear line. Simple sadness is more transactional. It's a reaction to a specific event. You lose your keys, you feel sad, it's temporary.
Right, situational.
Exactly. But sorrow, or this bittersweet feeling, it's more like an encompassing state. It's often tied to that bigger awareness of life's beauty, yes, but also its fragility, its impermanence, it's more existential.
And she uses art to illustrate this point really well, like Leonard Cohen.
Oh, perfect example. His work is the archetype, isn't it? He took his own deep personal suffering and longing and turned it into something that feels universal.
And it's not just sad music, is it? It's achingly beautiful, often because it holds that sorrow so openly.
Precisely. Which leads right into this paradox Cain explores. If we're told sorrow is bad, something to avoid, why do we actively seek out sad art, sad movies, sad songs, poems that make us cry?
Yeah, that is weird when you think about it. Why do we like feeling sad through art? What's the science behind that?
Well, the idea is that art gives us a safe container, you know, a controlled space to experience and process difficult emotions without being overwhelmed by them in real life.
Okay, a safe distance.
Right. And engaging with really moving, sad art can trigger the release of prolactin. That's a hormone linked to comfort, like the feeling after a good cry. It's soothing.
Ah, interesting. A biological response.
Yeah. And maybe even more importantly, because art is often a shared experience, even if you're just listening alone, you know, others feel this too. It takes what can be a very isolating emotion, sorrow, and makes it feel communal, shared, healing even.
That makes sense. Turning isolation into connection through shared feeling.
Yeah.
Yet, despite all this value, evolutionary, artistic, we're still kind of stuck under this tyranny of positivity you mentioned.
Right. And Cain makes the case that this tyranny is, historically speaking, pretty recent. It really got legs with industrial capitalism and the rise of the self-help movement in the early 20th century.
Why then? What was the connection?
The thinking was sort of happy, optimistic workers are more productive workers, more compliant maybe. So this relentless cultural command to perform cheerfulness took hold.
And the downside.
The downside is shame. When we inevitably do feel sorrow or melancholy, because that's part of being human, we feel like we're failing. We feel inadequate. So we hide our true feelings.
Wow. So that shame so many people carry for not being positive enough, it's not a personal feeling. It's a result of this, like, relatively new cultural pressure cooker.
That's a huge part of her argument. And often she says what we label as just unhappiness might actually be something much deeper, much richer. She uses the German word Sehnsucht.
Oh, that word. It's beautiful, but hard to translate directly, isn't it?
How did she say Sehnsucht here? Yeah, it doesn't have a perfect English equivalent. It's like a deep, wistful, almost achy yearning, a longing for an ideal state. Perfect beauty, perfect connection, something we sense is possible, but maybe just out of reach in this world.
Kind of like Plato's forms you mentioned earlier, that ideal version of things.
Exactly like that. It's that feeling that there's something more, something transcendent that we're reaching for.
And culturally, we tend to pathologize that feeling now, right? Like it's just chronic dissatisfaction or something.
We do. But Cain completely flips that. She argues that Sehnsucht, that deep longing, isn't a problem to be fixed. It's the noble, powerful engine behind almost all human creativity, innovation, and progress.
Wow. The engine.
Yeah. That ache we feel. It's proof that we can imagine something better, more beautiful, more just. It connects our messy, everyday lives to these big, transcendent ideals. If we never felt that longing, she suggests, why would we ever strive to build a better world or create art or deepen our relationships?
That really reframes that feeling. Okay, and she takes it even deeper, doesn't she? Into inherited emotions. Tell us about this idea of inherited grief and epigenetics.
Yeah, this is a really intimate part of the book. She looks at research in epigenetics. Now, this isn't about changing your actual DNA sequence.
Okay.
But it suggests that profound trauma or suffering experienced by our ancestors, say grandparents, great-grandparents, might leave chemical marks on our genes. These marks can influence how those genes are expressed in us generations later.
So we might be carrying like an emotional echo from the past in our biology.
That's the idea. Literally an ancestral sorrow or sensitivity. And Cain suggests that simply acknowledging this possibility that some of our deep, perhaps unexplained sadness or longing might have roots in our lineage can be incredibly powerful.
How so? Powerful in what way?
It provides context. It helps us understand maybe why we feel things so deeply. It connects us to our history, our family story. It can be a form of healing, really, to recognize we're part of this longer emotional narrative.
That's profound. Okay, so this brings us nicely to some of the big takeaways, the key themes running through the whole book. Let's maybe unpack three core messages that really shift how we see our inner lives. First up, reframing sensitivity.
Yes, this is absolutely central. The message is stop treating heightened emotional sensitivity, feeling things intensely, both the good and the bad, as some kind of flaw or weakness that needs fixing.
Instead,
see it for what it is. enhanced emotional intelligence. It's actually crucial for genuine empathy, for understanding nuance, for making meaning out of life's complexities.
Okay, so a practical reflection for listeners might be, next time you're in a tough conversation and feel overwhelmed by emotion, maybe don't try to shut it down immediately.
Right.
Lean into it a bit. That sensitivity might be giving you important information about what's really going on for you and the other person. Use it like radar, maybe.
Exactly. Yeah. Don't see it as noise. See it as data. The second big message is closely related. Sorrow isn't just something to endure. It can be a creative superpower.
A superpower. Yeah. Like how?
Kane talks about the wounded healer archetype. Think of someone like Abraham Lincoln. He famously struggled with deep melancholy his whole life.
Right. They called it melancholy then.
Yeah. But he didn't let it paralyze him. He channeled that depth of feeling, that understanding of suffering, into incredible compassion and transformative leadership during America's darkest time.
So the idea is that sorrow can actually deepen your perception. Give you richer material to work with.
Precisely. So if you're hitting a wall creatively, whether at work or with a personal project, maybe the answer isn't just to think positive.
Look then.
Maybe pause. Try journaling about the actual feeling of being stuck or the longing for the breakthrough. Tapping into that deeper, more complex emotional layer might be exactly what unlocks a really authentic, powerful solution or idea.
Okay. Sensitivity is intelligence. Sorrow is fuel for creativity. What's the third key theme?
It's more philosophical, but deeply practical, too. The unity of opposites, meaning that joy and sorrow, light and dark, bitter and sweet, they aren't really separate things you can choose between. They are fundamentally, inextricably paired.
So if you try to numb yourself to pain,
you inevitably numb yourself to the possibility of intense, piercing joy as well. You can't selectively dull emotions. If you shut down the bad, you also limit the good.
That's a challenging thought.
It is. But it's also an invitation to practice mindful appreciation. Knowing that a beautiful moment, watching a sunset, laughing with a friend is fleeting, is impermanent. That very knowledge can actually make the experience more vivid, more precious right now.
Because you know it won't last forever.
Exactly. That awareness is part of the sweetness.
Wow. Okay. The book is just full of lines that stop you in your tracks, that validate this whole way of seeing things. Let's share a few that really capture these ideas.
Yeah, there are so many quotable moments. I think a really foundational one is this. The bittersweet is about the recognition that light and dark, birth and death, bitter and sweet are forever paired.
What does that mean to you?
It suggests that real wisdom doesn't come from trying to eliminate the dark side or resolve the paradox. It comes from learning to hold both, to embrace the complexity.
Mm-hmm. And what about that feeling of longing, the Sehnsucht?
There's a beautiful line for that. Longing is the quiet, primal ache for a more perfect and beautiful world.
That reframes it again, doesn't it? Right. It's not just wanting something you don't have.
No, it casts it as this noble, almost spiritual impulse, a sign that your soul is reaching for something higher, something better, not just dissatisfaction.
Maybe one more about connection.
This one is quite bracing. To love is to accept that your heart will one day be broken.
Oof, yeah.
It's a reminder, isn't it? That real love, deep connection, it requires immense courage. It means being vulnerable, accepting that loss is woven into the very fabric of loving deeply. It's the price of admission, in a way.
Heavy, but true. Okay, so we've explored the philosophy, the big ideas. How do we bring this down to earth?
Yeah.
How can listeners actually apply these insights in their everyday lives?
I think the first, maybe most crucial step is just practicing emotional authenticity. Learning to recognize and, importantly, validate your own bittersweet feelings instead of judging yourself or trying to force cheerfulness.
How do you do that practically?
One way is what psychologists call emotional granularity. Basically, getting more specific with your labels. Don't just say, I feel bad or I feel sad.
Try to pinpoint it more.
Exactly. Are you feeling wistful? Melancholy? Are you sensing that ancestral sorrow we talked about? Maybe you're feeling poignant joy? Just naming the specific shade of feeling without judgment can be incredibly self-accepting.
Okay, get specific with your feelings. What else? Particularly for, say, people in leadership roles.
Oh, this is huge for leadership. Mm-hmm. Kane challenges that dominant model of the relentlessly upbeat, charismatic leader.
The performative optimist.
Right. She suggests that leading with authentic vulnerability, acknowledging challenges, complexities, even your own uncertainties, sometimes actually builds much deeper trust and psychological safety within a team.
Because it's real.
It's real, and that fosters more loyalty, more honest feedback, probably more innovation in the long run than forced positivity ever could. It's not about being negative. It's about being truthful about the whole picture.
And that third theme, impermanence, how does that translate into action?
Use it consciously. Use that awareness that moments pass, not to fuel anxiety, but to fuel appreciation, knowing that this pleasant moment, this connection, this achievement won't last forever. Let that knowledge sharpen your focus on savoring it right now. Make the fleetingness a reason to be more present.
Be present because it's precious, because it's temporary.
Got it.
Wow. This has been a really rich exploration of feelings we often push away. As we wrap up, what was the most surprising thing you took away from Kane's research?
For me, it was probably the cultural history piece. The realization that so many ancient traditions, Buddhism, Greek philosophy, Sufism, they didn't just tolerate bittersweet awareness, they actively cultivated it. They saw it as essential for wisdom, for spiritual growth.
And that contrasts so sharply with today.
Hugely. It makes our modern obsession with simple, mandatory happiness seem kind of shallow by comparison. Almost like we've forgotten something important that earlier cultures knew.
Yeah. For me, the biggest insight, the thing I keep coming back to, is the revolutionary permission Kane grants. This idea that the depth of feeling, the sensitivity that many of us were taught to see as a flaw or something to overcome, is actually a profound, maybe even necessary form of intelligence. It feels like permission to just stop apologizing for having a rich, complex inner world. Permission to be fully human.
Beautifully put. And Kane leaves us with this powerful closing thought, doesn't she? She suggests the world desperately needs what people with this bittersweet temperament offer, that capacity for deep empathy, for nuance, for grappling with complexity and truth.
So the final question for you, the listeners, may be this. How might your world, your workplace, your family, your community, how might it change if you chose, starting today, to lead not by hiding your complex emotional landscape, but by embracing it? By bringing your whole, true, beautifully bittersweet self to the table.
A provocative thought to end on.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.